This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Leonard Pitts Jr. is a nationally syndicated Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist. His job is to write about contemporary ideas and current events that shape our lives today. But he's recently taken on another role as a writer, that of a novelist. And for that, he turned to the past for inspiration. Leonard is the author of a new work of historical fiction. Freeman takes readers back to the time of the post-Civil War South, where black men and women were facing a complicated task of moving forward from slavery. Freeman is the second novel by writer Leonard Pitts Jr., and I am pleased to welcome him to the program this hour to talk about it. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
It's a very special piece of history that influenced you to write this book, classified ads in newspapers placed and paid for by freed slaves looking for loved ones that have been separated. They've been separated from their loved ones. How did you come across those messages?
Actually, I came across those in a book by a historian named Leon F. Litwack. Yeah, he did a book I read in the 80s called Been in the Storm So Long, which is about what the life for the slaves immediately before and then during and after the Civil War. And I was fascinated to read not just about the slaves placing ads, but about the slaves haunting refugee camps and having letters written for them, and most poignantly perhaps walking hundreds of miles trying to reconnect their families. I just think that is a tremendously powerful tale of commitment to family and to love, and it's also amazing to me that it's sort of a little known aspect of our history.
Can you give us an example or an example that illustrates the way these classifieds were written, the kind of language that was used, and the hope that's reflected in the messages?
Well, you'd have an ad, somebody that am seeking information of my wife, let's say Virginia. When I last knew her, she was in bondage to a trader in human flesh. They would use terms like that. In near Nashville, Tennessee. This was in 1856 and have not had any word since. Will gladly pay, a reward to anyone who can tell me where she is or who can, bring me information on her whereabouts, things of that nature. These were in freed men's newspapers for probably 15 years or so after the war.
No. And do these classified ads appear in the narrative in your novel?
Yeah, the classifieds do play a role in the novel, and the classifieds that I used are actually classifieds that I took from Leon F. Litwack's book, Been in the Storm So Long. So those are actual classified ads. There are a lot of or a number of incidents in the novel that are based in actual history that I use for fictional purposes.
Now, of course, these ads were placed in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War. Newly freed slaves may not have learned to read at this time. Who was reading these, and how did these messages get communicated?
Well, there's usually somebody in the slave community who has learned to read or has a rudimentary grasp of reading. There were also white missionaries who came down from the north, and agents of the Freedmen's Bureau, and they would also read and, for that matter, write things for the freed slaves.
How much additional research on slavery and the Civil War did you have to do to complete this novel?
I think I've been researching all along for 20 years. So in terms of slave life, there was not a lot of research that needed to be done. The research that I did, and it took about a year, year and a half, was just to enable me to create that world, or to recreate that world on paper is a very daunting task, and that's what I spent most of my time with, just trying to get the language patterns down and trying to learn little detail oriented things that will allow me to paint the picture more effectively. When you go to buy rice in a store in 1865, how is it packaged?
Mm-hmm.
This is not something you have to think about if you're setting a scene in a store in 2012. You depict a plastic bag with Uncle Ben's on the side or Mahatma on the side. But, what did it look like in 1865? Those are the kinds of things that I did my research trying to find out.
Did any of the messages that you found stand out in particular? Did you find one or two particularly moving?
I think they're all equally moving to me, especially knowing that most of them were ultimately unsuccessful. You're dealing with a situation where, people are you're talking about a population of 4 million slaves, and people are dispersed over, a pretty wide area, not just the immediate southeast, but, some perhaps have gone to the north for whatever reason. and you're talking about an era where the you know, the records are you know, incomplete, and in some cases have been destroyed. There are no computers or telephones or any of these other easy means of communications that we have now, and yet you're going to, you know, go to Mississippi to look for somebody that you have not seen for 5, 10, 15 years. That's it's an act of faith. It's a leap of faith, and as I said, most of the time it was not rewarded, and it was amazing those few times when it was.
Tell us about the book's two protagonists, Tilda and Sam Freeman.
Yeah, Tilda is Sam's wife. She's the woman that he spends, the book looking for. And unbeknownst to him, she has been marched by her now former owner, although he refuses to acknowledge that slavery is over. She has been marched away from Mississippi. He is marching away looking for a place where he will not have to live under what he calls Yankee domination. He does not want to live in the same country with, quote-unquote, the Yankee race. And she's a woman who has been, brutalized and beaten down so much that the very idea of being free traumatizes and frightens her. She has no idea what this even means. She's scared to grasp for it or to reach for it. Sam is, you know, something the opposite. Sam has been freed when we meet him for 7 or 8 years. Like Tilda, he is, they were both initially owned by a rather eccentric woman who allowed them to learn to read and who, gave them kindnesses that were not common among slave owners in that era. He's a literate man, and he's a man who takes not just pride in his literacy, but he's a guy who, you know, uses his words and his intelligence as sort of a shield against the disparagements and the denigrations that, you know, that come. You know, there's a scene in the book that takes place on a bridge where he is he's being demeaned by a couple of young white Union Army soldiers who are guarding the bridge, and he starts spouting this, you know, these big words, not so much to communicate to them, but rather to let them know that he is a man of substance. He is a man of education. So that's what I mean when I say that he sort of uses his language as a means of defense, as a shield.
And this certainly is a love story. Sam treks more than 1,000 miles to be reunited with Tilda. In one interview, you said that you envisioned the book as something of a love letter to African-American women. That's what you had in mind when you wrote the book. Did you feel like you did that when you were finished?
I hope so. I'll wait to hear more reviews from African-American women to see if that was achieved. You know, I always hesitate in saying that because I don't want people to misconstrue and think that, oh, well, it's a book that's been written to have appeal to only one, you know, element of the demographic. But by the same token, you know, I just think that there's something very powerful, particularly for African-American families in this era where family is so often defined by dysfunction and distance and absence. There's something very powerful in the idea that once upon a time it was common for a man to say, I'm going to walk 1,000 miles to find you. I'm going to cross the state. I'm going to cross the mountain. I'm going to cross the meadow to find you. That's a great love song. That's a great love story. And frankly, I think that in our current state of things, as African-American people, and frankly, as American people in general, we could use some reaffirmations of love.
And it points to something you made reference to earlier, which is the underreporting of this zeal, this desire to bring families back together all through the period of slavery and certainly in the aftermath when it became a little easier.
Yeah. After slavery, you had this rush. One of the first things that many slaves did to, sort of prove to themselves that they were free was to get married. I remember finding a website which just had, you know, hundreds of names of newly wed couples. And the thing that you have to remember is that slavery, under slavery, marriage was not legal for slaves. You know, they had the big ceremony where they, you know, everybody knows the sort of almost cliche ceremony where they jump the broom into, quote unquote, the land of matrimony. But fewer people know that the slave wedding vow went until death or distance us do part, because slave marriages had no force in law. So suddenly, after the end of the Civil War, you can get married, and it is something that is recognized and sanctioned by the government, sanctioned by law. That was a powerful inducement for them.
And that was a big step forward in the law, and yet certainly not, there was not total freedom in the aftermath. And I wonder how you conceived this idea of freedom itself as a kind of a relative thing in the post-slave age and the slope era, and yet not total freedom at all.
That's what the slaves had to sort of come to terms with. What, you know, how free is free? You know, what does freedom mean? Does freedom mean that I can leave this place and go some other place? Well, yes, although that can be dangerous. Does it mean that I can now demand to be compensated for my services, for my labor? Well, yes, but, you know, that can be dangerous. Does it mean that I can approach a white man on terms of social equality and look at him in the eye? No, it doesn't mean that. Mm-hmm. Does it, you know, so you have all these gradations and shades of freedom, which are not actual freedom as we would define it in the 21st century, but are certainly, you know, a vast improvement on what the slaves had known when they came out of slavery in 1865.
I think one of the interesting things about the novel is the setting itself. You know, we come to think about the Civil War as a discrete event. It took place. Glad that's over, and then on with the business of America. But this is a volatile landscape, America, in the post-Civil War era, and it's the setting where you have two characters separated by, you know, 1,000 miles or more.
Right.
So we have to traverse that volatile territory.
Well, the thing that people really fail to understand, you know, just how torn apart this country was, and frankly, what a miracle it is that this country still exists, you know, as it does. The Civil War was obviously the greatest schism in American history, but it's followed immediately after by the assassination of a president. And those of us, you know, those who remember or have some sense of what it was like and how distraught and this country was, and how traumatic it was when John Kennedy was assassinated, imagine that coming, and that's, you know, only the second act of a great tragedy. You know, that it's astonishing. And then you go and you look and you realize that there was the fighting did not actually stop with Appomattox. There were skirmishes for weeks afterward. There was no plan for, which kind of shocked me, but there was no plan for Johnson to secede Lincoln, even though he was the vice president. They did not quite know how to do this, how to make him the president of the United States. And there was fear that, you know, with the war, you know, with Lincoln being shot and the skirmish is still going on, the war is going to break out again, and that maybe, you know, the slaves who have thought themselves free are now going to be forcefully enslaved again. So there's a lot going on in the country, you know, in that those first days after the end of the war. It wasn't just, okay, glad that's done and let's move on. It was trauma, and it could have fallen apart. It could have broken apart at any given moment.
And economically, of course, I mean, that's the political travail. But if you think about economically, this country is now moving full bore into the industrial age. Not only the entire nation would become engaged, but the entire continent now would become part of this industrial revolution on the North American continent.
Exactly, and the South is, you know, because its industry has been destroyed, its railroad tracks have been ruined, its cities have been leveled. You know, the South is in a terrible position to compete in that, and that's one of the things, frankly, that's hobbled the South for the 150 years ever since. It's no mistake that, you know, the greatest poverty in this country is found, you know, in the states of the old Confederacy, by and large.
And what about the concept of Reconstruction? You talk about that and rebuilding, and that's all, you know, part of the context, the geographical context. Towns and communities are rebuilt. How about families?
Are we talking about the former slave families?
Yes.
That was a much more difficult, much more iffy proposition. It was not uncommon, you know, when the slaves did find one another, for, say, a man to find his wife and discover that she has a new husband. And so how does that situation get worked out? There was one occasion where a woman, you know, she told the men she would live with one man for 2 weeks, and then she lived with the other one for 2 weeks to figure out, okay, which one she wanted to be her true husband, or her husband for the future. There was one lady, I fictionalized her story in my book, but there was a lady who was walking around saying, have you seen my daughter? Have you seen my baby? She was such a beautiful little baby. You'd surely know her if you saw her. And people who questioned her found out that she's talking about a child who was an infant 20 years before. Mm. And the woman cannot, you know, she's broken. So the woman cannot get it through her head that her daughter, the infant, is now, you know, an adult woman if she survives. So, you know, there's a whole lot of obstacles to people, you know, getting back together. There's the social and political atmosphere that they're working in, but there's also the psychological trauma. There's the maiming. African American people, you know, and I've made this argument in other contexts. African American people were not just physically and economically, you know, maimed, but they were psychologically maimed by the Civil War and frankly the years after that. And I don't think anybody's ever really dealt with that in any kind of depth.
No, but you certainly have in your columns explored those ideas. How do you see this book fitting into that discourse about black community, black family?
Well, I would hope that, you know, in this era where, you know, again, so much of family, African-American and otherwise, is defined by dysfunction and distance and absence and all these things, I would hope that, you know, hearkening back to this history would wake us up a little bit and come to realize that there was once a time when we as African-Americans, we as Americans, did not need to be nudged to understand the power of family and the need of family to be together. I think, you know, to the degree that the book can have any kind of social impact beyond the entertainment impact, you know, it could have no higher legacy, I think, than that.
Leonard Pitts, thanks so very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Leonard Pitts Jr.'s new novel is Freeman. He will read and sign copies from it tonight at Quail Ridge Books and Music in Raleigh. 7:30 p.m. For more information, visit leonardpittsjr.com. That's the State of Things for today. Thanks for listening. Our website is stateofthings.org, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.